You can throw all the supplements or drugs at a patient you want. If they have not addressed their stress, it's not going to stick. Nothing's going to work.
Hi, everyone. Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today's episode is with Dr. Zandra Palma from Parsley Health, and we're talking all things HPA access. What's that? It's the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, and it has so much to do with how we deal with fight or flight situations. It has so much to do with chronic stress. It has so much to do with chronic fatigue and many other functions in our body. If you care about stress, if you care about energy levels, this podcast is for you. We recorded it pre-quarantine, but it could not be more relevant to our current times than ever. That's why I'm excited to share this podcast with you today. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I'm Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is Dr. Zandra Palma. Dr. Palma is a functional medicine physician with Parsley Health, and she has a background in internal medicine and anesthesiology. Dr. Palma studied human evolutionary biology at Harvard, then attended medical school at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. She wrote her first thesis in the field of contemplative care after an apprenticeship in New York Presbyterian Hospital with a chaplain named Sagan Glassing, who taught her how to integrate mindfulness-based practices into the care of terminally ill patients. And she completed her functional medicine training at the Kresser Institute Adapt Fellowship. Dr. Palma, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to be talking about all things stress, chronic stress, and we're going to kick it off by readdressing this world of adrenal fatigue. So I want to start at the basics. Before we get to adrenal fatigue, I want to start off with what the HPA axis is and why does it matter for this conversation?
Yeah, so I love this topic. We don't really use the term adrenal fatigue anymore. It's a little bit gauche in functional medicine circles now. You don't want to be the doctor saying adrenal fatigue at drinks after the conference. And the reason is it's just not a very good description of what's going on. It is very, very, very rare to have a case where the adrenals are tired and can't produce hormones because they're just worn out.
So actually, let's even start there.
Yeah.
Give us the history, because I brought it up because of that. And you're going to get into like why we think of it now as HPA access. So what did people think adrenal fatigue was?
Yeah, so they thought that the adrenals were getting tired. And this sort of came from the father of stress, the guy was the first guy who used the term stress as we use it today to describe, you know, psychological and physiological stress. It was this obscure term from metallurgy that described like twisting a metal and the strain on the metal. His name was Hans Selye. He was this Austrian doctor that worked in the 1930s. And he was, doing research, a young researcher at McGill University. And he wanted to see what certain pancreatic enzymes did to the body. So he decided to get a bunch of pancreatic juice and inject it into rats, basically. And while he was a very brilliant scientist, he wasn't the best pet keeper. So these poor little rats were a little stressed out because half the time he was poking them 100 times and not getting the right injection. He was chasing them around with a broom when they got out of their cages. So the rats were a little bit stressed. And what did he find but that every single one of the rats developed a stomach ulcer? And he was like, well, hot damn, I'm a genius. Pancreatic gunk causes stomach ulcers. But being a genius, he also had a control group where he injected, you know, placebo into the rats instead of the pancreatic gunk. And when he dissected those rats, he found out that those rats also had ulcers. So it started him thinking, you know, what's going on here? And he realized that he had stressed the poor little guys out through this whole process of experimenting on them. And that was the first time he used the term stress. And he kind of thought of it as an adrenal fatigue model. He thought that the adrenals were outputting so much cortisol so often that they literally just ran out of it. Like a military running out of ammunition.
Yeah, they were so low in cortisol that something needed to happen to correct the cortisol and then they would be okay.
Yeah, and that's not what was going on. it turns out it's a lot more complicated than that fatigue model. The adrenals themselves don't fatigue. And, you know, we talk about the HPA axis. Adrenals are the A, but there's two other organs we're talking about, two other glands, the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And those are both brain glands. The hypothalamus sits kind of in the middle base of the brain and sits on top of the pituitary. So it talks down to the pituitary. Then the pituitary talks to the adrenals. And it works in a sort of positive feedback. So the hypothalamus senses the stressor, sends a go message to the pituitary, that sends a go message to the adrenals, and the adrenals output cortisol. But there's also a negative feedback going back up. So that cortisol goes back and, you know, goes through the blood and communicates back to the pituitary and back to the hypothalamus, and it says, okay, we've already released cortisol, you can stop. So there's a natural break on the system. And so this HPA axis dysfunction is a dysregulation because those feedback loops are a little complex. It's a problem with the feedback loops. And there's also, so that's sort of like a more long-term chronic stress response. There's also a stress response that happens immediately, which also goes through the hypothalamus and the adrenals. But the hypothalamus skips the pituitary in this case, talks directly through nerves, through the spinal cord, and talks to the adrenals to get them from a different area called the medulla to get them to secrete adrenaline, or we say norepinephrine and epinephrine in this country.
So let's,
and that's the immediate sort of fight or flight stress response. And that, you know, we can also not come back from that very well, because people, when they have enough of that, they don't basically recover from that response by turning on the parasympathetic nervous system. And I can describe those two a little bit more in detail.
Let's zoom out and let's look at this from 40,000 feet up. Uh-huh. For the person that's listening here, they're like, wow, this is super fascinating. I'm not exactly sure what it all means.
Yeah.
What are some things that people might be experiencing in their lives or could have gone through that could relate to this HPA dysfunction?
Yeah. Okay. So HPA dysfunction, we think of coming from four main factors. Perceived stress is one of the biggest ones. And this differs greatly from the reason that the system evolved in pre-human organisms, because it evolved to deal with mostly physiological immediate threats to the body. So, you know, the organisms that first evolved this evolved it. Let's say you are a gazelle and you're being chased by a tiger, and the tiger's kind of gotten you, but you've sort of gotten away, but you're bleeding, you know, you're a little bit mauled, you need to get home, you've got a baby gazelle at home. That's what this system evolved for. Or it evolved for the tiger who hasn't eaten in 3 weeks and needs to catch this gazelle and feed his family. So that's what the system evolved for. It evolved to immediately turn on responses that will help us run, that'll help us hunt, that'll help us think. What it did not evolve for was for us to think, what if I get attacked by a tiger tomorrow? It didn't evolve for, you know, our cognitive worrying minds to kind of create these stressors without an actual physical threat. So now we define stress as a threat, real or implied, to the physiological or psychological stress, homeostasis of the individual, or the physical or psychological well-being of the individual. You know, so even thoughts now are stressors. So perceived stress is a big part of what causes dysfunction in this adrenal to brain loop. The other three are more physiologically based. So the other three are dysregulation of blood sugar, so spikes and troughs in blood sugar, kind of what you see with people who are on their way to developing diabetes or have diabetes. Another one is circadian disruption, so just your brain having a wacky time of whether it's day or night, and that happens mostly because of light exposure. Just living in cities, living with devices, having overhead lights, you know, not waking and going to bed with the sun. And the last one is inflammation, which is a giant category and the basis of, you know, all chronic disease. So inflammation causes HPA dysregulation as well.
So those are some things that can cause or an effect HPA dysfunction. But for the person who has it, who may not be familiar with that term, okay, HPA dysfunction, all right, I'm hearing about it for the first time. What are some symptoms that they're going through when that system is at dysfunction? What could be some diseases out there, or what could be some symptoms that people are going through on a daily basis that could be linked back to that?
Yeah, so we can talk about it in different body systems. So the brain is classic. In the brain, we see depression, anxiety, PTSD, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, which is sort of neurological and body. In the digestive system, we see IBS. We see dysbiosis, which is imbalance of good and bad bacteria. Metabolically, we see heart disease. We see cardiometabolic disease. We see obesity, diabetes. When we think about the reproductive organs, we see infertility, we see menstrual irregularities, we see low testosterone, we see PCOS. And the list goes on if you go through different body systems. But I think those are the big ones.
Pretty much everything and anything.
Yeah.
Can be connected back to this HPA axis.
It can be.
Which is why
back.
It's so central and so important, and especially if you've never heard of this topic before, it's really important to get a handle on it and get an understanding on it, because it plays into every aspect of our health.
Yeah. It plays into every aspect of our health, and it actually actively, you know, we're talking about broken brain, it actually actively remodels the brain. And that's not always something that can be reversed.
So what happens to our stress response system when it's always on? Because you're talking about this feedback loop mm-hmm. being broken, in a sense of it's constantly in a state of worried, mm-hmm. whether real or perceived. The tiger tomorrow often is what we're encountering in today's society. I have an intense meeting with my boss. I'm worried about this relationship that I'm in, whatever it might be. So in a state of chronic stress that's there, chronic perceived stress, how does that affect our stress system and constantly keep it on inside of our body?
Yeah.
And so what's the impact of that for us?
Yeah. So if you think of stressors and you kind of stack stressors against each other, your stress response should sort of look like a peak and then a come down and a trough. But if you have many of those, and you have peak and peak and peak and peak, eventually your body will either have chronically high cortisol on the high end because it's adapting and thinking like, well, why come down? I might as well just stay elevated. And then on the other side of that, it can be elevated for so long that your adrenals think that your pituitary and hypothalamus are basically crying wolf. And the adrenals start to say, they're not fatigued. They're just a little lackadaisical. So you have chronic under response to stressors. And if you think about the, you know, how the system evolved and the way this would function ideally, is stress is a good thing in the short term, like we talked about. So when you have a stressor, when you're being chased by the tiger, there are a couple things you need to turn on and there are a couple things you need to turn off. You need to turn on energy mobilization. So you need to take cash out of the bank, turn it into cash to spend right now. So that means mobilizing energy from your muscle, from your fat stores, from your liver. Now that you've mobilized that energy, you need to get it to the muscles. You need to get it around the body where you need to use it. So you turn on the heart, you increase the blood pressure, you increase the heart rate, you know, getting that energy to your leg muscles in 2 seconds rather than five is the difference between life and death for this gazelle. You also need to turn on your immune system. Maybe this gazelle's bleeding out. He's being dragged through the dirt and has cuts all over him. He's probably going to need some extra help fighting off pathogens later when he recovers. You also need to turn on your brain. You need to be sharp. Your senses need to sharpen. You need to be able to think your way out of a situation. What you don't need to do is any long-term projects. You don't need reproduction. You don't need to grow, you don't need building, you don't need digestion right now. So you turn all of that off. But what happens if you're doing that over and over and over? So let's think about the things you turn on. You turn on energy mobilization. You take energy out of the muscles. So long term, now you're causing muscle wasting, muscle atrophy, muscle catabolism. And the medical term for low muscle mass is sarcopenia. And that's actually one of, and you wouldn't think this because you never hear about it, one of the more leading causes of death for elderly people. You now put that energy into the blood. So you have chronically elevated blood sugar. This means that you're going to have something called insulin resistance, be at higher risk for obesity and diabetes. And then the heart stuff, if you're elevating your blood pressure to 180 over 120 while you're being chased by the lion, that may save your life. If your blood pressure is 180 over 120 every time you walk into your office, you're going to have a chronically elevated stress-related high blood pressure. And that eventually remodels the heart and remodels the arteries, right? Our arteries become less elastic and less plastic. They get injured on the inside from, you know, high pressure going through the same tube. And the blood has to pump against this high pressure in the same size tubes. Sorry, the heart has to pump against the blood against the pressure of these same size tubes. So the heart now has to remodel itself, become more muscular, become more, more likely to suffer a lack of oxygen, like a heart attack sometime. When you turn on the immune system in the short term, that's great. In the long term, either you have an overactive immune system or you do the opposite and you have such a low immune system that you can't fight off basic things. When you turn on the brain in the short term, that's great. In the long term, we remodel the brain. We run out of dopamine, which is, you know, it feels good. It's released in acute stress. Over a long period of stress, you run out of dopamine. Now you have a symptom called anhedonia, which is the joylessness we associate with depression. You destroy a part of your brain called the hippocampus, responsible for memory and learning. You shut down BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which feeds our brain and makes new neurons. So you're inhibiting the production of new neurons in the hippocampus. You're pruning neurons. You're increasing the space between those synapses. And the hippocampus is literally losing weight. So, you know, memory problems, brain fog. There's another part of the brain, a brain structure called the amygdala, that's actually where fear lives. It's associated with fear. And unfortunately, high stress hormone, high cortisol, causes that area to grow. So now you're losing the memory part and you're increasing the fear part. Now you have anxiety. Now you have anxiety that's not even related to actual threat or actual stressors. You just have these primed fear loops, and that area becomes not only larger and gains weight, but more excitable. So there's all sorts of negative brain remodeling associated with chronic stress. And then if we talk about the things that we're shutting down in that acute stress response, the reproduction, the digestion, and the growth and repair, imagine shutting those things down long term. You have infertility and reproductive abnormalities, low testosterone in men, PCOS, amenorrhea in women, that's not ovulating, not having a cycle. You have thyroid issues, growth hormone issues. You have something called psychosocial dwarfism in children, which is when, you know, you look at the kid, you look at the kid's health, there's no nutritional deficiency, there's no organic body health problem. They're just under such extreme stress that they're years behind on their growth curve. And when you look at their growth hormone, in many cases, it's almost zero. There's a really interesting case a long time ago of a boy who had this psychosocial dwarfism and was living in like a, you know, a really abusive home. So was taken out, was put in a New York hospital and developed this relationship with a nurse, which was probably the only normal relationship he'd had with a caring adult that made him feel loved in his life. And his growth hormone within weeks went from zero to the growth hormone of a normal boy his age. The nurse went on vacation and his growth hormone went back down to zero. Mm. And she came back and it went back up immediately. So, you know, how much that boy was depositing calcium into his bones was literally dependent on him feeling safe and loved.
So you're trained in internal medicine, uh-huh, and later on continued your training in functional medicine. What did you learn in med school about the HPA axis?
So you really, and conventional endocrinologists really focus on these things. You really focus on the extremes, and the extremes are mainly long-term disorders that are congenital. So you don't really see most people having these problems. There's an extreme of low cortisol called Addison's disease, or an extreme of the adrenals actually not working. This is adrenal fatigue. This is called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. But people are born with a congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and people with Addison's disease, it's a very serious autoimmune mediated disease. JFK had Addison's disease. On the side of high cortisol, you have people with Cushing's disease. This takes often actual destruction of the gland to bring them back from this. So you know, in functional medicine, we're thinking of the shades of gray in between that, that come from adaptation. It's our body's natural adaptive response to repeated stressors that either puts you high or low on a cortisol curve, but not as high or low as Cushing's disease or Addison's disease. That's sort of the bread and butter of normal endocrinology, conventional endocrinology, when it comes to the adrenals and the HPA axis.
Sort of like your goal as a functional medicine doctor is to catch things years before they maybe have a formal name of a disease, but you're noticing it now because it has an impact in a patient's life. So when patients come in, what is a archetype or a typical story that you might hear from a patient that comes into Parsley, where you're a physician, and when they come in and they start describing some of the things that are going on in their life, and you have the first hint that maybe something might be going on with their HPA axis?
Yeah, so let's take some of my New York patients, for example. These people have anxiety as one of their top complaints, chronic fatigue, and maybe they have IBS or a gut disorder. Maybe they have had, let's say it's a female and she's had some female hair loss that she can't regrow. She has alopecia. She doesn't know why. She, despite being very, very healthy, has high markers of blood sugar. Her hemoglobin A1C is 5.7. She eats perfectly. So where is that coming from? And then you start kind of looking into her lifestyle and what she does. She does CrossFit 6 times a week. She's a banker. She works probably 60 hours a week. She has 3 kids and is going through a divorce and eats a perfect diet, really, really super low carb. But you know, as in terms of the food, the sourcing, everything's from Whole Foods. Everything's organic. Everything's expensive. And this is a sort of typical pattern. This person will probably adapt to having high cortisol over time, and over an even longer period of time, their cortisol will probably drop off a cliff, and they'll have low cortisol and an inability to respond to acute stressors. And reversing this involves kind of winding back all of those behaviors.
But it sounds like you're saying it calls for reversing back is winding back life. You know, so many of those things are entrenched into life. So what are the first places that you even begin? Actually, I'll even start even more basic. So let's say you have a hunch that something is going on with the HPA axis. Is there, what diagnostics or laboratory testing are you including in the mix, or that you would traditionally do, that you're looking for these markers to see that something is actually going on?
Yeah, so I do in everybody, just, we all do this at Parsley, just a really thorough blood panel first. So we're looking at markers of different organ function, all the basics, the thyroid, taking a really good look into the thyroid. We're looking at, you know, their liver, their kidneys, all the basics. We're looking at high level inflammatory markers. We're looking at markers of nutrition, high-level nutrient markers. We're looking at markers of their cardiometabolic status. We're looking at markers of their metabolic status, like blood sugar. That's kind of the first pass. But when I really think something's going on specific with the adrenals that I want to see, I actually like to do specific cortisol testing. There's a couple ways to do it. You can do it in saliva. You can do it in urine. You can do it in dried urine. You can do it in blood. Not many people do that in practice. And I really like, my favorite testing is from Precision Analytical. It's called a Dutch test, which is a dried urine test. And it basically, we have, you know, the patient takes home a kit, they pee on a strip kind of 4 times throughout the day. It tells us, it can tell us about the stress hormones, but also the sex hormones if we want. It can tell us the variation throughout the day, because that's really important. So cortisol is not this static thing. It's not the same level all the time. It is sort of lowest while we're sleeping. We're, you know, just chilling. It's super low. And then it starts to rise in the early hours of the morning, and sort of that rise naturally wakes us up. And then it's highest within the first hour of waking. And then it sort of drops throughout the day. We go to sleep, it drops even lower. And then the whole cycle happens again. So one type of HPA axis dysfunction is not even high or low cortisol. It's a problem with that rhythm. So maybe you're high at night, you're low in the morning, you're going to have insomnia and daytime fatigue. Or maybe you just have a flat curve. You know, maybe your cortisol doesn't have that nice movement throughout the day. And a flat curve is really associated with negative health outcomes. We know from a study that in women with metastatic breast cancer, a flattened curve actually predicted poor survival times. We know from a large longitudinal study called the Whitten-Hall 2 study that a flattened diurnal cortisol curve was associated with increased all-cause mortality, and the big excess was in cardiovascular deaths. We know that it was associated with increased rates of type 2 diabetes and obesity. So that movement over the course of the day is really important. So I like to do a test that will show me that movement. So that's not blood. That's something I can get a little, you know, more samples during the day. And I like to do a test that will show me metabolites and a couple other molecules that interconvert so I can get a good picture of what's going on sort of in a biochemical sense.
You mentioned the thyroid earlier. Mm-hmm. How are the adrenals and the thyroid and the HPA axis all connected? Give us the lay of the land and how thyroid health plays into it.
Yeah, so it should really be called the HPA-TG axis. So T for thyroid and G for gonadal axis, because the hypothalamus and pituitary talk to all three glands. They talk down in that same pattern to all three. So they talk to the adrenals, they talk to the thyroid, and they talk to the sex hormones. And then you've got all this crosstalk between those three glands, between the thyroid, the sex, the gonads, and the adrenals. And the thyroid is like a very sensitive endocrine organ. It's sort of the middle child of the body. It gets its feelings hurt very easily. So if something's going on in the gut, it'll probably knock your thyroid off its balance. If something's going on with the adrenals, with the sex hormones, perceived stress, we also know affects the thyroid by itself. Adrenal dysfunction also probably affects the thyroid by way of the gut. The gut is a way that a lot of these are connected, by affecting species composition and also by way of the sex hormones. So it's a little bit of a complicated picture, but they are all connected and all related.
And that's why when I originally reached out to you and said, you know, I really want to do a podcast on thyroid, mm-hmm. and we want to go into that. We get so many questions on thyroid. In fact, a friend had to reach out to me and she was asking me some questions and I was like, let's get you out of here. Let's talk about thyroid. You're like, well, we can talk about thyroid, but let's really talk about the HPA axis because that gives you the framework to understand it all.
Yeah.
Because you want to see what and how the thyroid is being influenced. So let's just take some common things that people have heard of and to make sure that we understand the connection. So in the case of hyperthyroidism, mm-hmm. how would that play into the axis? Not saying that it only relates to that, but what's going on in the body and what component would be there with the HPA axis?
So, you know, hyperthyroidism typically comes from something called Graves' disease. It's not very common, so I'm going to spend less time on it than hypothyroidism. But Graves' disease is an autoimmune attack on the thyroid. So is the other most common type of hypothyroidism. And autoimmunity, we know, is affected primarily by stress. So we know stress is one of the three factors that predict progression and morbidity of all autoimmune disease. The other two are how you sleep and how you move. So stress via the adrenal glands is definitely affecting the thyroid. Hypothyroidism is a lot more common and is also autoimmune in most cases in the developed world. So in the classically, in the underdeveloped world, we usually think of hypothyroidism as an iodine deficiency problem, and it is in the underdeveloped world. But, you know, in the developed world, we have adequate nutrition. We put iodine in the salt. So most hypothyroidism, in fact, 90% of cases, is due to, whether people know it or not, something called Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, which is autoimmune hypothyroidism. So again, that autoimmunity is being worsened by chronic stress, by elevated cortisol or inability to respond. That's it.
So talk about cortisol. You hinted at it earlier, but cortisol resistance. Mm-hmm. I just want to expand on that a little bit. You kind of talked about it earlier, but we didn't really fully flesh it out. So how does cortisol resistance play into the HPA axis?
So it's that negative feedback loop we're talking about, that, you know, in an ideal working HPA axis, the cortisol released by the adrenal gland would have a feedback inhibition on the pituitary and the hypothalamus to tell it, okay, no more go signal, we have enough cortisol. It's when those glands experience so many repeated stimulations by cortisol that they become insensitive. This happens across the body with many different hormone systems, right? Insulin sensitivity. When you have chronically elevated insulin, your pancreas starts to just become a little insensitive to that signal. It happens with leptin. It happens with a lot of hormones you might have heard of.
So sometimes patients are experiencing chronic fatigue syndrome. How could that be possibly connected to cortisol and the HPA axis? Is there a connection that's there?
There's absolutely a connection. And in the research, it does happen with both high and low cortisol. But in the research, it's a little bit more associated with low cortisol. We know that chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia both are not only associated with low cortisol, but are really tightly associated with adverse childhood events. And adverse childhood events kind of prime that brain remodeling years before. And they prime remodeling through the immune system in the brain, cells called astrocytes, which are these important immune systems that feed our neurons and feed our brain cells.
And not everybody in our podcast has heard the episodes that we've done on the topic of the ACEs study and things like that. So could you just expand on it a little bit more? Like, what is it and how could somebody know if they've gone through those experiences?
Yeah, an adverse childhood event could be anything from, a loss early on, like the loss of a parent, to a chronic abuse, to being bullied, to being put down over a long period of time, to, some immediate event that was a threat to life, like being really scared because you almost drowned in Frozen Lake. Any of those sorts of things can really prime the brain and the adrenal system.
And people, you can Google it. We'll include in the show notes. There's some past podcasts that we've done. And there's also a link online that people can take a questionnaire, right? The ACEs questionnaire, to see if they've gone through those. So the reason that you brought that up is you're saying that even experiences from when we were young, traumatic experiences or perceived traumatic experiences that we didn't have the tools or didn't resolve or didn't have the tools to be able to resolve in the best way that we could to support resilience, can impact the brain and how we continue to respond to stress and process hormones in the body.
Yeah, and those tend to be associated with the low cortisol patterns. Low cortisol. Yeah.
Let's go back to that patient that you were talking about in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they're out here in LA too. And
I'm sure they are.
It's
yeah.
worldwide. We talked about some of the labs that you would be looking at when it came to HPA axis dysfunction. When it comes to treating them and supporting them, and I was making a joke saying that we're going to unwind those things, which is kind of like unwinding life because they're so entrenched. Where's the first place that you often start, knowing that it's highly personal?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the biggest bang for the buck that you start off with? Or is that based on their labs and conditions in life?
I love this question because it does empower the patient, because the first 12 things I do are not supplements and they're not drugs. And that it was sort of a hard thing for me to learn this and to recognize that these, like, what I thought of as like soft interventions are actually the most important interventions in HPAD. Because, I did have this background of anesthesia. I love drugs. I love giving a drug and seeing it work and it being so reliable. And that does not work in HPA axis dysfunction if you haven't addressed other things. So it took me a while to get there. But after, seeing repeated patients and realizing that you can throw all the supplements or drugs at a patient you want, if they have not addressed their stress, it's not going to stick. Nothing's going to work. So I think one of the first things they really have to address is perceived stress. And perceived stress is a tough one because, like you said, with this woman's lifestyle, there's some things you can't change. You know, I can't change other people's stressors. I can help them change their response to stressors. And one of my favorite ways to do that is meditation. You can try to, you know, reduce somebody's stressors by telling them to do things like, you know, delegate tasks, get help. You can tell them to do things like stop looking at, you know, Facebook or Instagram or any social media. If it's bad for them, it can also be good for you. You know, you can also have positive inputs. If you scroll down my Instagram right now, it's like all pictures of otters and baby goats, and it's great for me.
And videos helps. Of you talking about favorite foods yeah. and things like that.
Yeah. And it actually releases oxytocin, which does reduce stress. So you can give people strategies to help them release oxytocin, like increasing play and pleasure and sex and physical touch and social connection. You can, you know, tell people to stop getting in pointless arguments, direct them toward like a little bit of stoic philosophy, maybe go on a news fast, change the type of news you watch. And that can reduce your stressors a little bit, but most people's stressors are not going away. Most people's stressors are their job, their kids, their commute, and their, you know, their relationships. Some of those are a little bit changeable, but a lot of them are not going away. So you have to change the way that you respond to stressors. And the best way that I've found, and you mentioned this a little bit in my bio, is meditation. And I think particularly loving kindness meditation was sort of what I studied with that monk, Saigon Glassing. And they call it metta meditation in Buddhist tradition. And that type of meditation, you know, we were teaching it to patients to help them die well. These are patients that were in the palliative care part of the hospital. But that type of meditation, learning it, actually probably saved me from the ravages of HPA axis dysfunction, because I was in medical school. I was in my, you know, fourth year of medical school. I was getting burned out. And that probably turned things around for me and allowed me to be a much better doctor, ultimately, because you can't be a decent doctor if your own body is broken.
And yet, I mean, I have so many doctors in my family and they're always running so hardcore. Yeah. And they're doing that. What can you remember when you first encountered this practice of this loving kindness meditation, this monk? What were some of the first signs that you saw in your body, changes or the way that you would perceive things? Like, what did you notice when you first started to get into the meditation?
Yeah, I noticed that I just had a lot more sort of freedom of my choice and how to respond to situations that would have kind of like set me off before. I just had a little bit more space around that decision of how I'm going to respond.
And I know we were chatting a little bit before the podcast started, and I was asking you if you had your own hero's journey when it came to health, and you were like, no, I kind of like just have always been into this, and yeah. I would read about it on my downtime. But did you notice anything physiologically for yourself? So in addition to how you responded to things, would you notice any shifts in your body, or how you would did you notice any physical changes in your body?
I do notice signs of decreased inflammation if I'm on a meditation program and I'm meditating well. I really like a program, everybody should check it out, by Emily Fletcher, who came and presented to us, called Ziva. And when I'm really consistent with that, I do notice decreased signs of inflammation. So I had a back injury in the OR a long time ago and had pain for quite a long time, at least like 2 years of kind of like 7 every day. And pain's a sign of system-wide inflammation. Pain is one of the classic herald signs of inflammation, and my pain goes down if I'm meditating daily. I notice kind of other inflammatory signs in my body change, just, you know, the way your skin looks, where you carry fat, those things change with meditation, I think.
You know, there's this article on, it was all over the internet the other day, but it was basically talking about some recent studies that have come out about how powerful honey is when compared to traditional cold medication for kids, mm-hmm. kids above the age of 1, mm-hmm. that honey works better than placebo and works better than cough syrup and everything else that's out there. And it was like a definitive thing. The individuals that were sharing this research, I think, was NIH funded. And it made me think that, going back to this comment that you made earlier, that soft interventions that we often so overlook them because we're waiting for the magic pill
yeah.
or the magic bullet that's out there. What's another example, separate from meditation, what's another example of a what would be considered traditionally as a soft intervention that actually is fundamentally important to HPA, HPAD?
Yeah, so we've talked a little bit about circadian dysfunction, either that flattened daily rhythm or it being inversed or something being a little weird about it. And the best thing you can do is change your exposure to light. So that seems like a super soft intervention. But the way that our hypothalamus senses what time of day it is, or the way that our brain senses what type of day it is the light hits our retina. The retina communicates back through the optic nerve straight to the hypothalamus, to a part called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And then that sets our circadian clock. So in the daytime, we associate bright daylight rays, which have a lot of blue tones in them.
Like this fake studio that makes it look like day.
So they have a lot of blue tones in them. So our brain associates that with day. During the night, typically there are a lot more orange tones in the light and the light's lower. Our brain associates that with night. Our brain associates full darkness with complete night. So one of the most simple things you can do for people with circadian dysfunction or even high cortisol is give them blue light blocking glasses and tell them to, at some point in the morning hours, especially if they're having a problem getting that good, mounting that good cortisol peak in the morning, you want them to get bright daylight, maybe in the even first thing in the morning, at least a half an hour of bright daylight in their eyes. They don't have to be outside, they could be by a window. But you want that bright daylight in their eyes. If they can't get it, you want them to get a full spectrum light box and just sit in front of it. And then you get them these blue light blocking glasses, which I have and my boyfriend thinks are very cool. And wear them after dark. And there are two flavors, you know, you can
Does
get
he have his own pair?
No. Yeah, I don't think he would ever. So you can get two flavors. You can get the ones that have clear lenses that you don't look so dorky, and you can wear those sort of just after the sun sets. Maybe you're still at work. Maybe, you know, you're out and about. You don't want to go full dweeb yet. But then if it's getting later, especially if you're working on a computer screen, which are classic for blue light rays, TVs emit a lot of blue light. Even overhead lights emit blue light, but devices especially. If you're working on a device, if you're watching a TV, absolutely use like the completely orange blue blockers.
We forget how simple things like light impact us. I was at my girlfriend's house one time pretty early on, and she was always talking about like at night she gets this like second wind. And of course, everybody's different and their patterns and their cortisol levels and that sort of thing. And I remember her going into her bathroom to like wash her face and get ready for bed. And her lights were like office, like studio level bright in the bathroom. And I was like, babe, let's try something. You know, I just had gotten her this Juve light that was in the bedroom. I was like, just use that and like it'll shine enough into the bathroom so that you can see. And just changing from going from turning the typical bathroom lights on, which were so bright at night. Mm-hmm. We get back at 10 p.m. from a dinner. She'd be tired on the ride back over in our Uber. We'd get home, she'd go in the bathroom. She'd come back, she's like, I'm up. I wanna like go read something, do something, whatever it might be. And just switching to just doing the orange light, because I didn't think that she was gonna wear the glasses at the time.
Yeah.
And having that shine in and brush her teeth, wash her face, do everything, I could see how much that would just have her relax a little bit more and get ready for winding down and get ready for bed.
Yep. And then diet's huge. I mean, diet's huge for everything, but if you think of inflammation as one of the main causes of HPAD, having an anti-inflammatory diet is key. And then having a nutrient-dense diet is key, because you can be too low on nutrients that your adrenal glands need to do their job. You can be low on, you know, B vitamins. They need the B vitamins. They need a lot of vitamin C more than any other place in the body. They use more vitamin C.
Before we go to the next one, from what I was reading from some of the work you were mentioning about Chris Kresser and having done his program, and you had sent us some interesting articles that he had put out there on HPAD. One of the things that it seemed, if I want to, you know, try to get this right, but I might have gotten it completely wrong, so please correct me. There's also this thing where sometimes people think that the immediate thing to do is to focus on their diet. Not that diet isn't important, it's so key, but often a lot of the people, men and women that you see, their diet is perfect, right? They're eating low carb, they're doing these things, but their blood sugar can still be affected because their stress levels.
Exactly. So stress hormones, the class that cortisol is in, are called glucocorticoids. So it tells you right there in the name, gluco. These hormones affect the blood sugar system and affect blood sugar trafficking. So people can be eating perfectly and eating in a way, you know, in a way that we would tell somebody with prediabetes to eat, which is lower on carb count, but you know, still have dysregulation of their blood sugar system even more because they're so stressed out. But I would say for people with HPA axis dysfunction, they oftentimes need to not be so low carb. Sometimes you see them developing HPA axis dysfunction after a long time on a super low carb diet. And sometimes they do need to optimize protein intake, definitely. So they need to be higher on protein count. But eating some carbs, and especially eating those carbs at night, tends to help with HPAD.
One of the things you were mentioning about the archetype of the patient that came to you in New York is also working out. You know, we think of working out as being such an important factor. It is, and I'm sure you're going to get to that in a second. But let's go towards this modern trend of CrossFit and other aspects. Every person is different, but how is more maybe not better when it comes to the HPA axis?
Yeah, more is not always better, especially with high intensity cardio. And these type A people, like this patient I talked about, love high intensity cardio. They love CrossFit and they love high intensity cardio. And you know, we know from studies of reproductive age men that these guys who love long distance running, run like 20 miles a day, they have testosterone that looks like an 11-year-old boy. And they have lower sperm counts. And that's mediated through the HPA axis. That's mediated through the stress hormone system. We know what's, you know, causing that suppression of the gonadal production of hormone. So oftentimes when somebody has HPAD, they need to pull back on exercise. They need to pull back particularly on high-intensity exercise and high-intensity cardio. So, you know, if they're really struggling with HPAD, a lot of times at first you only want them to be doing some walking, maybe some swimming. Chris Kresser swears by Tai Chi and Qigong. I've never done them myself, but they seem like really good interventions because you're getting sort of like a little bit of that stress reduction and mindfulness and a little bit of movement. You don't want somebody to be completely sedentary. You do want them to be moving, but you know, they've withdrawn so much from their adrenal bank account that they need to start putting deposits in before they have any energy to work out. And you'll often see these people not recovering well. So you can tell that their adrenals aren't liking that level of exercise because they're having what we call post-exertional myalgia or post-exertional fatigue, where their muscles are hurting more than a couple days after their workout, or they are so wiped out they have to go straight to sleep after a workout. So you need to escalate these people back slowly, back with a little bit of movement. As they begin to recover, they can do a little bit more, but that's sort of a dangerous stage because a lot of these people are, to some extent, at least sort of emotionally addicted to that high intensity exercise. So you have to make sure they don't jump right back in too quickly and sort of build up, put more deposits into that bank account before they can make big withdrawals again.
And you can still do resistance training without it being CrossFit.
Yeah.
You know, there's different programs that are out there that are more chill, but you can still do some resistance training.
Of course. And weights. I love yoga. Certain types of Pilates are a little bit more mellow.
So let's talk about, we were talking about food and you were saying anything that increases inflammation inside the body. What are some other factors that are separate from food? How much do we have to be thinking about? I mean, I know as a functional medicine doctor, you're always thinking about environmental factors or other things, but do you often see those playing into HPAD or not really?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always thinking, it's sort of my little brain crush right now is environmentally acquired illness and complex chronic illness. So I'm always thinking about environmental insults. We know that certain environmental toxicants disrupt all the endocrine system. So they're endocrine disruptors. They disrupt female and male hormones. They disrupt thyroid hormones. They disrupt adrenal hormones. These are things like BPAs, phthalates. We know heavy metals do to a certain extent. We know that if somebody has HPAD and we find out that they have heavy metal overload, when we remove those metals through chelation, their HPAD tends to get better by itself. And a lot of times HPAD can be downstream from some toxic insult this person has a, you know, a good lifestyle and is pretty stress-free, and it just turns out to be something toxic. It's really interesting. The two things that are very correlated with low cortisol that I talked about earlier, chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, those are also both very related to mold illness. So we see a lot of people with mycotoxin overload who have high levels of mold toxins in their urine who have those two kind of herald symptoms and disorders. And so it seems like one is affecting the other. I've never seen any patient that's sick with toxic mold that doesn't have some adrenal dysfunction. And to wind somebody back from a chronic illness, you have to deal with the original offender, which for those people might be toxic mold, but you also do have to work on the adrenals.
Because it's a chicken and egg situation. They're both making each other worse. Mm-hmm. And so without addressing them both at the same time, it's very hard for the system to get back into sync. Mm-hmm. So for anybody, I'm sure people ask you all the time because mold is starting to become a little bit more well-known. Mm-hmm. People are talking about it. You were in New York previously and you were saying after Hurricane Sandy, it was a big, you know, big thing.
And now it continues to be a big thing. I mean, I think New York, a lot of the buildings just have a lot of mold. So I see, you know, I was seeing it a lot in New York in my patients. And you hear these people's stories, and these people are very ill with complex illnesses in all different parts of their body. They'll have neurological symptoms. They'll have GI symptoms. You know, they may have cardiovascular symptoms. They pass out. They, you know, can't maintain a good blood pressure. And you ask them when everything kind of just crashed and went downhill. And a lot of people will tell me around 2012. So I started thinking about it. And I was like, 2012, what was this? Was it like, was that like a weird year in the Chinese zodiac? Then I remembered that Sandy happened. And I was in fact exposed to high levels of mold after Sandy in like a, in a basement apartment that flooded for a while.
Yeah. And here in LA, I mean, just being by the beach. And one thing that I noticed a lot is that I was sharing earlier is that because it doesn't often rain that much in LA, when it does rain, water gets caught up in buildings and you don't really realize that something is leaking unless if it rains a ton. When the El Ninos come around every 10 years, people start to notice these leaks that are happening and they're like, oh my gosh, they open up the wall, they see all this mold that's there. So just to be more hypervigilant, because we did a few episodes on mold and we'll link to those in the show notes. And just even the World Health Organization estimating that 40% of buildings in, you know, the Western world are like dealing with mold. So that's quite high.
Yeah, it's quite high. And I know you had Anshippi on the show. I won't go into it too much, but just the way we build buildings now makes them more prone to mold. Mold loves drywall. It's like popcorn for mold. Loves drywall, loves flat roofs, loves swamp coolers. So, you know, there's a lot of modern building stuff that just predisposes our homes to mold.
So I was asking you a question, and the question was, you know, what's the biggest bang for the buck? And we were going through this list and these items. One of the things that I see that is tough for people sometimes, but is so crucial to this, and I'd love to get your take, is sleep. For somebody who's had HPAD and is dealing with it right now, you often notice that their sleep is irregular or dysfunctional. Yeah. How do you tackle the topic of sleep?
Yeah, sleep is absolutely one of those crucial things we have to do first, and one of those soft interventions that it took me a while to come around to realize that I had to optimize. But sleep can be the, you know, if you had one intervention to do, it might be sleep. I mean, sometimes you have to get it sleep through meditation and through stress reduction.
Yes,
but
meditation can help you sleep better.
But especially for autoimmune disease as well, sleep is so key to preventing progression and morbidity of the disease. And usually you have to clean up somebody's sleep hygiene. So simple things. It's, you know, a lot of these people aren't sleeping well. It's things like making sure they're even in bed for long enough. You know, some people don't get, you have to, most people have to get 9 hours in bed to get 8 hours of sleep. And most people, you know, there used to be this old myth that some people only need 6 hours of sleep. Those are massive outliers. Most people's cognitive function deteriorates below 7.5 hours. So people need, almost all people need 8 hours of sleep. So that means they have to be in bed for long enough. So they have to schedule out time for that. That means that they have to do simple things like keeping their room cold, keeping their room dark, doing the light hygiene stuff that we talked about, taking some time to wind down before bed, making sure they're not drinking alcohol very close to bedtime. Sometimes people are eating really close to bedtime and that's waking them up. Or excessive alcohol, making sure they're not drinking caffeine in the afternoons. Things you would think that are common sense, but a lot of people just have poor habits around sleep.
For yourself personally, being a doctor, speaking, posting on social media, doing, having your busy schedule that you've had, what's been the, I'm sure there's been your own challenges with sleep. Think about the last couple of years. What's been, for just you personally, I'm always curious, I'm always asking the guests, what's been one of the biggest things that's helped you sleep better, just on a personal level?
So I'm a good sleeper.
Okay, great.
I was one of those babies who like came home from the hospital and just slept through the night.
Yeah, and that stayed
ever since. Yeah, I've been a good, in fact, I probably slept too much in college and obviously med school, I didn't get to sleep that much, but I was probably an oversleeper at some point, and now I'm kind of coming back to normal. But I will say, have you had anybody on the show who's talked about grounding or earthing?
Yeah. Well, not specifically that as an episode, but a few times they've mentioned it. But for our listeners who aren't familiar, would love you to talk about it.
Yeah. So I was pretty compelled by the research. So grounding or earthing is the idea that if you're wearing kind of rubber-soled shoes or if you're not connected to the earth or something that has the same electrical charge as the earth, you probably don't have the electrical charge that you should, because we evolved to be touching the earth. So it's going outside barefoot, walking on the ground, and you can get these little grounding pads for your bed. So I was pretty compelled by the research that I saw. There are a couple really strong publications in cardiovascular journals. And then I watched this movie called The Earthing Movie, the Grounding Movie, The Earthing Film, something like that on YouTube. And I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to try this thing. And I brought this thing home, and I don't have sleep problems, but I do sleep really well on it. My boyfriend is sleeping better than he's ever slept on this grounding pad.
Do you know the name? Would you feel comfortable mentioning it?
Yes, I think it's Grounded Beauty.
Grounded Beauty.
Yeah. And then I also have this cheap little red light that it's not a Juve. I haven't sprung for like some sort of fancy red light yet. I literally have the kind that you shine on plants. And I just clip it by my bed and I kind of just like turn it on before I go to bed and just like shine it on me. And I don't even know if it's doing the things that real red light are doing. Probably has some of the rays in the appropriate range. But it just kind of makes me feel warm and nice and ready for sleep.
Sometimes people's sleep is off because they're in a relationship and their partner doesn't always sleep well. Any tips for some of your patients that come in about things that they should do, especially for couples? You know, sleeping together in the same bed is a very recent phenomenon when it comes to human beings. What are some sleep hygiene things that can be added in to make sure that you're sleeping well if you're sleeping in the same bed with somebody else?
Yeah, get divorced. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. You know, some people don't use earplugs. Earplugs are pretty important. But I think, you know, if I were to really think about this in sort of a functional medicine way, root cause, fix the other person's sleep, right? If they're not sleeping well, or if they're snoring, like get them a sleep study, get them checked out for sleep apnea. You need to make sure they're healthy too.
So, love that. I always tell people often too, it's like people have different temperatures. So have different comforters.
Yeah.
Sometimes people like it warmer, colder, whatever it might be. I want to go back to something that we talked about briefly in your bio, which was human evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
You studied that at Harvard in undergraduate. How do you, first of all, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
And how has it influenced your practice?
It influences my practice every day. So what it is, it's the study of evolutionary biology, which is thinking about the factors that lead to adaptive changes in organisms, and it's asking why are organisms the way they are now? You know, why do men prefer a certain waist to hip ratio in women? What's that about? The other examples I can think of are all sex related, so I'm going to skip them. So it's asking, you know, what?
How did we get here?
How did we get here and how did we adapt? And there's a classic concept in evolutionary biology called the EEA, which stands for the Environment of Evolutionary Adaptedness, which says whatever the environment looked like at the time that the organism did most of its adapting, because adaptation kind of tends to happen in these spurts. So at the time when the organism did the most of their adapting, whatever that environment looked like is the one that's going to best suit them, right? And Chris Kresser talks about kind of having an ancestral lifestyle. That's the way he thinks we should eat and move. The way that our ancestors who were in the EEA ate and moved, the soil quality that was around then, the way they lived in social groups, the size of their social groups. And so I think about that stuff a lot, and it's probably why I was attracted to functional medicine and why, I mean, I've been reading about this kind of stuff. A lot of the stuff I shared with you earlier was research that came from a professor called Robert Sapolsky at Stanford, who wrote a book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers that I was required to read in my college endocrinology class. So I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time. And I think it's why I liked functional medicine so much. That's why I was reading it in my spare time.
Yeah, and it's not to romanticize the past, but to say that that's where we came from. And what you're saying is where most of the adaptation ended up happening. And we're still in that same framework. We're still in that same biology. It's just that our lifestyle and our environment around us has completely changed. So it's not easy to live that way anymore. And we're suffering from the consequences.
Yeah, we're suffering from the consequences of a mismatch. And Robert Sapolsky always says, we have the privilege of dying of these chronic diseases and watching our bodies fall apart over 80 years because we're not getting killed by a lion at 20. But asking how to unwind that, how do we not be as susceptible to those constant stressors? And how do we make sure that our body's not spending so much time on the stress response that it's getting sick from the stress response instead of sick from the stressor, right? That it's neglecting, that it's putting so much of its resources into producing a stress response over and over and over, that it forgets to put its resources into basic things like reproduction, digestion, and tissue repair.
In your practice, you talked about meditation being a part of it and something that you recommend to your patients. Are there any other books about philosophy or untangling the mind or mindset? Because you had this monk who influenced you. Do you ever give any recommendations to your patients when it comes to those category of books, whether people would call them spiritual books or mindset related, that have been helpful for you that you pass on to them?
Yes, but it's been a long time since I read this stuff. I do recommend a lot of programs and some apps. I recommend Ziva a ton ever since I met Emily Fletcher.
Emily's great. She's brilliant. Been on the podcast twice.
Yeah, she's so great. I will give you a list. I'll email you a list of books so you can put them at the bottom. A lot of them I read, in college during that period with that monk. And those were more based on using loving kindness in medical settings. Mm-hmm. And then there's some other books I recommend to people that I can't remember the names of, but I will send you a full list.
You can send it to us and we can include it in the show notes here. When we were talking about the list of conditions and symptoms that people could be experiencing if they have HPAD, it was quite long and I chimed in. I said, well, it's pretty much everything. And it is in a way. It can be related to so many different things that we face today. And for a lot of individuals that can feel quite daunting of, I have to look at my perceived stress and inflammation and then like my circadian, and then I have to look at my sleep hygiene and this component and that component. For anybody who's struggling or feels like they are dealing with HPAD, what's like the hope that you want to share from what you've seen on the other side of working through patients at Parsley, that you've seen what's possible? What hope do you want to leave people on the podcast with?
I would say this not just for people with HPAD, but for people with anything. I have some patients who come in who are struggling with serious health problems who are really, really, really young, 16, 17, 18. And I always tell them that, the good thing about this period is that they're going to learn so much about their body right now, and they're going to become so in touch with their body over the course of trying to heal this. And not to say it's going to be fast to recover, but by the time they do, they're going to be years ahead of their 23-year-old friends in terms of their health habits and how well they know themselves and what they're doing to prolong their life.
That's an important message. It's almost like you're dealing with it now so you don't have to deal with it later on. And regardless
and
of what age
you
are.
And not just so you don't have to deal with it. You just learn a lot about your stuff through these periods of health issues. You learn a lot about how your own body works. You learn a lot about how to take the best care of it. And for some people that happens later, and for some people that happens earlier. But whenever it happens, it's if you actually commit the time to fixing it, because nobody can fix it for you. You know, every doctor probably wishes that we were that magic person that could just fix a patient without them committing to helping. But they really have to do the work. So if they're ready and if they commit to doing the work, they're going to learn so much about themselves that they're going to be a ninja in their own body in a couple of years.
And how amazing that your body is even letting you know that something's wrong and that something's off and that it needs your attention. Like, we're so lucky to be alive, of course, but we're so lucky that our body communicates that way. It doesn't always feel that way when you're in the midst of dealing with something that's out there, but we are really lucky. Otherwise, if our body didn't say something was wrong, one day we would just wake up and just drop dead.
Yeah, and these are all adaptive changes that we're talking about. You know, these are issues that come from a normal adaptive response. It's just being triggered too much.
Well said. Well, where can our listeners keep in touch with you and tell us about some of the things that are happening in your world?
Yeah, what's happening in my world? Well, one really cool thing that's happening in my world is that Parsley, where I work, Parsley Health, just launched a Complete Care Anywhere product, which means that you can see me as a doctor without being in the same city that I'm in, or without being in New York or LA or California, where I'm licensed. You can see me from anywhere, which is really cool. So if you want to see me as a physician, you can sign up through Complete Care Anywhere through Parsley Health.
Great.
Which also means that I can live in Berlin for part of the summer, which is very exciting.
Is it the plan?
Yes, that's the
plan. Oh, that's exciting. So full-on telemedicine, is it okay to call it telemedicine for people to understand?
Yeah, it's telemedicine. Yeah, it's telemedicine. It's slightly different than us seeing patients in person. If I see a patient in person, I can basically kind of participate as their primary care provider. If I can't have the opportunity to work in the same state where they are or examine them, then I can't do that. But we can still participate in your case, communicate with your other doctors, and, you know, be your functional medicine doctor remotely, which
That's
is really
super
cool.
Super exciting. Because so many people, I mean, exciting. Parsley's in LA, in San Francisco, in New York, but a lot of people don't live in those areas.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have a lot of international listeners on this podcast. Can people internationally work?
Absolutely. Yeah. I see a bunch of people internationally.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's really fun. And if you want to find me,
yes.
I have a website that's a little bit in beta, but it's about to be really cool. My friend Sammy just designed this special animation for me for my birthday. So
animation about you?
No, it's an animation just that says my name.
Oh, that's cool.
But it's cool. That's sandrapalma.com. And then, if you want to see me on, I put a lot of content on Instagram, probably more than I end up putting on my website right now, just because it's easy. So my Instagram is zandrapalma_MD. And oftentimes you'll see me on the Parsley blog online or on the Parsley Health Instagram as well.
Yeah, writing cool articles and sharing great information. Well, Dr. Palma, thank you so much for coming on the Broken Brain podcast, educating our listeners, sharing your experiences, talking about sleep hygiene and everything else.
Cool glasses.
And if your boyfriend ends up listening, he's got to give him a shot. You got to give the glasses a shot.
I think he just thinks I look so darling in mine.
You know where they come in really handy? Flying. When you're flying and you don't want to experience jet lag, or
they
you want to minimize
so
jet lag.
They're so handy.
That's what I've found, is that they look really gnarly, like you work like as like an electrician, or you're welding something that's there. But I've convinced many people who were skeptics by giving it to them when we were going for an international trip. They would wear them on the flight because flights are so bright, you know?
And I fly JetBlue a lot, and they specifically only have blue light. Like, even at night, it's like this blue light shining. So I'm always rocking blue blockers on my red eyes on JetBlue.
Well, we'll have to have you back, and you'll let us know if it worked, if he ended up wearing them on the flight to Belgium. Thank you again for coming on the Broken Brain podcast. We super appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.